welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau, of Creighton University's Department of History. Although his ambition was to become, as he put it, the best Ethiopian songwriter, referring to black minstrel music, he vacillated between composing minstrel songs and songs in the sentimental style popular in the early and middle decades of the 19th century. He suffered financial, morale, marital, and alcohol problems, but in the end, Stephen Foster earned an honored place in the music history of the United States. Foster is the subject of our interview this week, but before we get to him, let's take a look at an event that occurred this week in history. There is no secret what major event took place this week in history. On July 4, 1776, the Continental Congress announced the separation of 13 North American British colonies from Great Britain. It explained why the Congress on July 2nd, unanimously by the vote of 12 colonies, New York abstaining, had resolved that these colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states. Richard Henry Lee of Virginia made the motion for independence on June 7th. On June 11th, a committee was appointed to prepare a statement justifying the decision, consisting of Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Roger Sherman, and Robert Livingston. The document was prepared largely by Jefferson, and after considerable heated debate, the resolution for independence was adopted on July 2nd. 2 days later, the justifying document was voted and Congress ordered it titled The Unanimous Declaration of the 13 United States of America. It opened, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bonds which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. The declaration was put on parchment, and beginning on August 2nd, members of the Congress began to affix their signatures, a process that took several months to complete. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, we are pleased to announce that as of this week, the Organization of American Historians has joined Creighton University in jointly sponsoring Talking History, the program to which you're listening, and that airs nationally via the public radio satellite system. The Organization of American Historians is the largest learned society devoted to the study of American history. Since its founding in 1907 as the Mississippi Valley Historical Association, the OAH has promoted the study and teaching of the American past through its many activities that involve teachers at all levels of education and the general public. The organization's sponsorship of Talking History is consistent with that effort. In addition, however, the OAH publishes the Journal of American History and the Magazine of History and hosts annual meetings of the nation's leading American historians. For further information on the OAH, visit the organization's website at www.oah.org. And while you're at it, visit Talking History's website. Simply go to the Creighton University site at www.creighton.edu, find the index, and click on Talking History.
Camp down, lady, sing your song.
Do that, do that.
Camp down, race, that's 5 miles long.
Oh, do that, day.
I come down there with a hat cave in.
Do that, do that.
I go back home with a pocket full of tin.
Oh, do that, day. Wine run all night, wine run all day.
Stephen Foster left us nearly 200 songs, for most of which he wrote the words as well as the music. They include some of the best-known songs in American music history, Camp Town Races, My Old Kentucky Home, Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair, and Beautiful Dreamer. Here to tell us about Foster's life and contribution to American cultural independence is Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
On July 4, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson both died. On the same day, Stephen Foster was born. Adams and Jefferson had helped win American independence and shape the nation's political culture. Foster, the country's first professional songwriter, would blend white and black musical forms and, in the process, help create a distinctive American popular culture. With me today to discuss this development is Ken Emerson, author of Doodah, Stephen Foster and the Rise of American Popular Culture. Mr. Emerson, welcome.
Well, thank you, Dr. Nielsen. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Tell us at the start, what was America's popular culture like in the early 19th century? In fact, was there a popular culture?
Oh, there certainly was. People whistled and hummed a Yankee Doodle, and they read Ben Franklin's Poor Richard's Almanac. But popular culture was much more provincial and localized. For one reason is that at that point, America did not have the steamboats, locomotives and trains, telegraphs, and cheap printing processes that were able to link together communities into a larger mass culture. So it was localized at that point. Those innovations did not come along until the Jacksonian age and made popular culture as embodied by Stephen Foster on the broader scale possible. And a second problem, and another reason why America's popular culture back in the early 19th century was provincial, was because there was no copyright protection, and it was much cheaper for American publishers to pirate English books and sheet music. After all, why pay an American when you could just rip off a Brit for free?
Now, Foster himself was born into a fairly proper white middle-class home, and yet, like kids today, he was drawn to black music, or at least what he thought was black music. What was going on there?
Well, he was attracted, as indeed almost the entire nation was, by the rebellion and the release that imitations of black music offered. It's not unlike rock and roll or rap music today. He found, as many kids did, that this sort of the genteel culture of the parlor and the ballads sung by the ladies of the house, with the men joining in, were somewhat stifling and straight-laced. It's a little bit like Huck Finn wanting to, you know, go off on the raft with Jim or Tom Sawyer wanting to get away from Aunt Polly.
He's torn, though, it seems, as you tell the story of his life, between the music of the parlor, proper white music with piano accompaniment, and black minstrelsy, what comes to be known as Ethiopian music. What was that conflict all about? Was he able to resolve it in any way?
Well, there was a conflict on a number of levels. First of all, he did yearn for, as a nice bourgeois boy, for genteel respectability, even at the same time as he was rebelling against it. Secondly, he was deeply troubled by what he called the trashy and offensive lyrics of blackface, which is to say, their frequent use, their crude caricatures of African Americans, and the use of the N-word and other various racial epithets, which Foster himself in his earliest songs used. But he felt very uncomfortable with that. And so gradually what he tried to do was to fuse the parlor ballad the Ethiopian or minstrel song. And he did that partly by elevating the language and the diction of black minstrel songs. For instance, when he wrote the song, Toll the Bell for Lovely Nell, My Dark Virginia Bride, Nellie was a lady, last night she died. No white songwriter had ever called an African-American woman a lady before. And so gradually, culminating in a song like My Old Kentucky Home, where there is no black dialect at all, he tried to sort of elevate the quality of blackface minstrel songs so that they were more comfortable with, compatible with a parlor.
You write in your book, Doodah, that September 11th, 1847 is a firm date for the birth of pop music as we still recognize it today. What happened then?
Well, that was the day when a song was first performed, and that's Oh Susanna, was first performed in public in an ice cream saloon. In those days, saloons didn't necessarily serve liquor. This was also the height of the temperance movement, and ice cream was a common refreshment. But in an ice cream saloon in Pittsburgh, and Oh Susanna became the first of Stephen Foster's great hits. It became an international sensation, and obviously even today we can still sing it. And it really embodies what I would call the sort of the multiracial, multicultural hallmarks of what we recognize as American popular music. That is to say, it's about an African American who has a banjo on his knee as if he were a medieval European troubadour with a guitar serenading a lady. At the same time, the beat of Oh Susanna is a polka. which at that point was this wild new dance that had gone from Poland and Bohemia to Paris and had recently arrived on American shores. So that the way that this song combines all these different racial and ethnic and cultural threads, I think is prototypical of American popular music.
Before reading your book, I hadn't been aware of the influence of Uncle Tom's Cabin on Foster, particularly in my old Kentucky home. What was that influence all about?
Well, he read Uncle Tom's Cabin. He was not predisposed to approve of his abolitionist politics because Stephen Foster was from a Democratic family and indeed was related to by marriage to President James Buchanan. He was a so-called dough-faced Democrat, as they were called at the time, who would have tolerated any accommodation of slavery in order to keep the Union together. But the story deeply moved him. Not only did he identify, did he feel, being himself a very sentimental person, very moved by the sufferings of the black characters, but also the female character who dies tragically in Little Eva, who dies in the book and is sort of a Christ-like figure, probably reminded him of his own eldest sister who died when he was young. And it died in somewhat similar circumstances, meaning that she died in Kentucky. And, of course, the song became My Old Kentucky Home. And so I think that in Stephen Foster's imagination, the stories in the book, in the novel, melded with his stories in his own life. Now, when he wrote the first draft of the song, literally the title of the song was Poor Tom, Good Night. Subsequently, he removed some of the explicit references to Uncle Tom's Cabin, but the song is still about the breakup of a slave family on a plantation, and this family is being sold down the river to harsher circumstances on plantations in the Deep South, as happens in Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Mm-hmm. Well, as is so often the case, the second, third, and fourth verses of Foster's songs reveal more, I think, than what one might get simply from singing along with the first verse. One reads the subsequent verses of My Old Kentucky Home and finds that it's about a slave family that is, as you say, being sold south. The sugar cane shows up in the later verses.
Yes, I think that one of the reasons why the first verse is sort of hooks you into the story but doesn't really tell you is that's how he gets you, which is to say that by writing a lovely melody that really engrosses you, you're in too deep to get in to back out by the time that you realize that the song is quite different. But even today, with My Old Kentucky Home, which everybody sings on Derby Day over Mint Julep, you think of it as a celebration of ladies in crinoline and life on in the Old South, the mm-hmm. plantation life and Bret Butler, but it's really quite the opposite, and as such, a very moving song.
Now, you make a point of describing Foster as America's first professional songwriter. He makes a decision at a very early point in his life to make his living by making music. How did that decision come about, and was he successful?
The decision came about because he gave away the manuscript to Oh Susanna, to a publisher. He didn't even know that it had any monetary value, because at that point, the profession of being a songwriter did not really exist. People who wrote songs supported themselves either by performing them like a rock star today, by giving music lessons, by running a music store. But when a publisher made a lot of money off of Oh Susanna, he realized, hey, maybe there's something here. And so he did make the rather audacious decision to become a full-time songwriter. It was in some ways as presumptuous as somebody in the 1940s deciding to become an astronaut. The profession literally did not exist. He was, however, successful for the first, let's say, 10 years. Modestly successful, but enough that he could keep his, he married shortly after becoming a songwriter, and he was able to support his wife and daughter. But the hits stopped coming, and he got further and fell further and further in debt. And in some ways, it was simply, it's like the Internet and all the dot-coms that, you know, have gone belly up, which is to say popular music was had not yet developed infrastructure to support people. I mean, that's why, I mean, because in as much as he was one of his creators, and the business was still in its infancy, in the same way that all these people who are doing creative work in dot-com businesses, most of them haven't figured out actually how to make money from them yet. in 10 years, they will. Just as songwriters, the next generation for Foster, the smart, cagey ones made a great deal of money.
He writes, through much of his career at least, two kinds of music. Sometimes he fuses them, but often one can see a distinction between the parlor songs and the so-called Ethiopian songs. Is one genre more successful for him than others?
Yes, the so-called Ethiopian songs, which then became called plantation melodies, were much more successful during his lifetime. I mean, today we think of Foster and we think of I Dream a Genie with Light Brown Hair or Beautiful Dreamer as big songs, and they certainly are famous, but they were not terribly successful. You know, successful during his lifetime. As a matter of fact, Beautiful Dreamer was published posthumously. And I Dream a Genie was a minor hit at best. And this was frustrating to him in some senses because it's sort of like the clown who wants to play Hamlet. He had so much success with his blackface songs that he kept trying to write, and this also contributed to his downfall commercially, is he kept trying to write ballads, parlor ballads, but they did not recoup, they did not earn the kind of royalties that his blackface songs did.
You're currently, I believe, researching the Brill Building. This is the building in New York City where songwriters like Carole King and Neil Sedaka worked in the 1950s and 1960s. I'm curious, now that you've looked at both centuries, how did the production and consumption of American musical culture change in the period from Foster to the Brill Building?
Well, first of all, you could make money doing it. Referring back to this, what we were just talking about an industry that not yet developed an infrastructure. By the 1950s and 60s, the period I'm talking about now, there was this infrastructure, but there was also something actually quite similar in a way, and that is this was the beginning of rock and roll. And in the same ways that Stephen Foster took minstrel music and blackface minstrelsy and made it respectable and even made it commercially successful for middle-class people, the New York songwriters took rock and roll, the sort of the crude raucousness of rockabilly, and dressed it up. I mean, they added strings, for instance, all the great Grifter songs, which scandalized most fans of rhythm and blues. So in the same way that Stephen Foster made minstrel music for the white middle class and respectable for the white middle class, so too did a lot of the New York songwriters make rock and roll respectable for a white middle class audience.
You have a beautiful paragraph in your introduction. You say that Foster is so absorbed in the air that we breathe and in the airs that we hum that we seldom, if ever, think of him. Yet an America without Foster is as unthinkable as an America without Whitman or Twain, without Louis Armstrong or George Gershwin, without rock and roll, without racism. Could you elaborate on that, if you would?
Well, that really is the reason why I wrote the book. And as a matter of fact, that paragraph is a paragraph that I wrote almost before I began the book. As a writer, I've always been interested in looking at our racial, the tangled, torturous racial complexity of America. And I felt a challenge as a writer and also a challenge as an American to try to understand our culture, and not to sort of sweep it under the rug of a political correctness, or for that matter, political ignorance and incorrectness. Talking about Foster is difficult. It's especially difficult talking about Foster with African Americans, to whom he is a very powerful, hateful symbol. And any African American over the age of 40 has painful, humiliating memories of being forced to sing Old Black Joe in school. But on the other hand, this music has endured in a way that the more hateful, racist music of the minstrel era has not. And I wanted to try to get at this, and one of the things that when I discuss this with African-Americans, or especially in African-American classrooms with kids, is the music racist? Of course it is. So is American history. So now, what do we do with it? And I want simultaneously to sort of look at the music, warts and all, to discover, as well as its warts, its beauty. And I think this is one of the appealing things about popular culture in general. It does reflect our history and what's really at the heart of our lives and our minds and our souls, and that's why it's popular.
We have only about a minute or so left. There are fewer pianos in American living rooms now than there used to be in Foster's time. As you've just mentioned, many of Foster's lyrics are deeply problematic, racially offensive. Does he still have a place in our culture in the 21st century?
Oh, I think remarkably so. As a matter of fact, one of the songs that he wrote, Hard Times Come Again No More, which was a modest hit in his own lifetime, has been recorded in the last 10 years by almost everyone you can think of. I mean, Bob Dylan, Emmylou Harris, the opera baritone Thomas Hampson. It was the beginning number and the ending number of the film Georgia, starring Jason Lee. And one of the reasons why Foster's music has a place in our culture is that it is so incredibly elastic and flexible that people can adapt it to their own purposes. You can do Stephen Foster music as country music. You can do it as pop music. When you think of Ray Charles's first great hit, actually, the first hit by Ray Charles, one of the great rhythm and blues and soul musicians, that was a hit on the white charts, was Way Down Upon the Suwannee River, the Suwannee River Rock. And his previous songs, because he did not have melodies or references that were immediately identifiable to whites, were strictly on the R&B charts. Foster is continually being rediscovered and reinterpreted in ways that make him come alive.
Mr. Emerson, thank you for speaking with us today.
It was a pleasure. I enjoyed the conversation immensely.
You've been listening to Ken Emerson, the author of Doodah, Stephen Foster, and the Rise of American Popular Culture.
If you want to learn more about Stephen Foster, the subject of our interview this week, we've just the site for you. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
New York bandleader and composer Bob January has devoted a portion of his website at bobjanuary.com to composers of music. And featured on this site are several pages and photographs of Stephen Foster, his parents, siblings, and others, along with a complete family history. You will find copies of letters he wrote, pictures of where he lived, went to school, performed, and his musical instruments. You will also get a sense of the history behind some of the songs Foster wrote. The site offers a complete history of the composer, his family, and is a thorough look into the life and times of America's famous folk song writer, Stephen Foster.
On July 4th, 1826, the United States celebrated its 50th birthday with parades and speeches across the country. As Andrew Burstein explains in this week's op-ed, it was a watershed in the nation's history, a bright moment when the successors to the revolutionary dream examined their own lives as they took inspiration from and found nostalgia in the accomplishments of the founders. Burstein is a professor of history at the University of Tulsa. He's also the author of America's Jubilee, How in 1826 a Generation Remembered 50 Years of Independence.
The first widely celebrated 4th of July was 1783, the year the Revolutionary War officially ended. As a historian of early America, I became curious about the 50th anniversary of American independence, July 4th, 1826. Surely Americans did something on the day of America's National Jubilee, even if our historic memory does not include that moment any longer. Abraham Lincoln recalled the day in a speech he gave from the White House portico, but today, that whole generation is forgotten, the children of the original revolutionaries. So that was how my book, America's Jubilee, was born. In researching it, I wrote down the speeches and ceremonial toasts at public banquets. "To Congress," said one Philadelphian as he raised his glass, "so much has been said by it that we will say little of it." A keynote speaker in Salem, Indiana on July 4th, 1826, hailed the sacrifices of grizzled veterans. "Hungry, naked, and wounded," he said, "they repressed their emotions with a hope that they would bear to their destitute families the well-saved earnings of their toil and blood. But that's not what happened. The majority of the soldiers who fought for independence came home with pockets empty. Now, after 50 years, shame-faced politicians debated how they could make amends. to the few surviving veterans so long disregarded by Washington. There is great poignancy in the stories of 1826. Ruth Bascom's father had 50 years before conceived a new means of military preparedness. He called them Minutemen. The letters remained in his family. Train the militiamen to use the bayonet, he wrote, to strike greater terror in our enemy. His daughter Ruth has left us 57 years of diaries chronicling her life as the wife of a rural New England minister. On the 4th of July, while her husband was off giving a speech in a neighboring town, Ruth received a surprise visitor, a pious black man, she called him. She invited the preacher in for breakfast, and he talked to her about race relations in America on July 4, 1826. If anyone remembers anything about the Jubilee, it's the perfectly timed deaths of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. They both died, incredibly, that very day. The coincidence was widely interpreted as proof that ours was one nation under God. And Adams's precious last words have come down to us, too. Jefferson survives. But those immortal words might just be a big fat myth. You gotta read the book to find out. America's Jubilee taught me a great deal, but especially that we already felt superior to the rest of the world after our first 50 years. We lied to ourselves when it came to the details in order to make 1776 the book of Genesis and a still evolving story about a chosen people. We were flawed, just like now, but deeply engaging and unalterably romantic about ourselves as a nation.
You've been listening to Andrew Burstein, the author of America's Jubilee, How in 1826 a Generation Remembered 50 Years of Independence, published by Alfred Knopf. This is Talking History.
In life's pleasures and count it many tears, while we all stop sorrow with the fool.
Finally, turning to our list of coming attractions, if you're traveling south this summer and looking for some history, try the Jamestown Settlement and Yorktown Victory Center Museums in Williamsburg, Virginia, also the home of Colonial Williamsburg. In July, visitors can learn about the maritime activities of the Jamestown Colonials, who populated the first permanent English settlement in America, founded in 1607. Through the canoe, capstan, and cargo program, you could try your hands at boat building, handling ships and cargo, and learning how early Virginians relied on waterways for transportation, food, and commerce. For more information, contact the Jamestown Settlement and Yorktown Victory Museums in Williamsburg, Virginia. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
The host of Stephen Foster at the Hotel Paradise. This is what I told him as I gave him to his eyes. Rooms were made for copper, towers made for spires, ships were made for cannonade to fire off from his side. And Captown ladies never sang all the tunes. No, no, no. Captown ladies never sang. No.